The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off today with Welcome to Oprah Insider, Oprah on the shocking first page of her latest book club pick. This article is by Oprah Winfrey. Happy Sunday, Insiders. I hope you're all having a relaxing weekend. If you are following along with my book club, we're in our first week of reading Long Island by Colm Tobin. It starts off with a shocking discovery. I don't like to give away spoilers, but everything I'm about to tell you happens in the very first pages, which you can also read on Oprah Daily. The main character, Eilish, a mom of two, answers the door to a stranger who tells her that his wife is pregnant with her husband's baby, and when the child is born, he plans to leave the infant on her doorstep. It's what Eilish decides to do and not to do next that makes this novel so riveting. I suggest you clear your day when you start reading this book because you will not want to put it down. So I'm curious, Insiders, what would you do in this situation? That's my question for you this week. Would you help your partner raise the baby? Or leave because they broke your vows? Knowing the way life imitates art, I suspect that at least one of you in the Insider community has experienced something similar. I look forward to hearing about all your experiences in the comments below. I'll see you here next week. So over in the comments about this Oprah Insider, our first one is from angel.aavir. To that question, it all depends on the relationship. I don't think it's a black or white answer. If you're in love with your spouse and forgiveness, rebuilding trust, honesty and all those good things are in play to be able to recover from that type of betrayal. It's a much different situation than perhaps a relationship that's been dead for years or decades. So many people stay because of blind loyalty, even in the face of abuse, heartbreak, and feeling like they have no options to change. By grace, sometimes, life gives you a situation that pushes you to firmly make a choice to be free. And at other times, it's a lesson to grow. In the novel, I think Eilish, been ready to leave, just saying that was her line in the sand. This next one is by Doris 10. I would try my best to give the innocent victim, the baby, unconditional love, to welcome the baby into my family and raise it with love, like I would do for my other children. I agree with Mary, the two women should bond and raise the baby together. I would also get the adults involved in marriage counseling and parenting classes. Now I'm going to get the book today and read it because I'm already hooked. The weather in Hawaii has been very rainy and stormy, so it's a perfect day to settle in with a good book. Thanks, Oprah. So we're heading over to books. The unforgettable scene that kicks off Oprah's 105th book club pick. Long Island by Colm Tobin has betrayal, earth-shattering secrets, and deadly threats all within the first few pages. And this article is by Colm Tobin. That Irishman has been here again, Francesca said, sitting down at the kitchen table. He has come to every house, but it's yours he's looking for. I told him you would be home soon. What does he want? Eilish asked. I did everything to make him tell me, but he wouldn't. He asked for you by name. He knows my name? Francesca's smile had an insinuating edge. Eilish appreciated her mother-in-law's intelligence, and also her sly sense of humor. "Another man is the last thing I need," Eilish said. "Who are you talking to?" Francesca replied. They both laughed. As Francesca stood up to go, from the window Eilish watched her walk carefully across the damp grass to her own house. Soon Larry would be in from school, and then Rosella from after-school study, and then she would hear Tony parking his car outside. She finished working at 3, so she could be there when they came home each day. It was something she did not want to miss. This would be a perfect time for a cigarette. But having found Larry smoking, she had made a bargain with him that she would give up completely if he promised not to smoke again. She still had a packet upstairs. When the doorbell rang, Eilish stood lazily up, presuming that it was one of Larry's cousins calling for him to come and play. However, from the hallway, she made out the silhouette of a grown man through the frosted glass of the door. Until he called out her name, it did not occur to her that this was the man Francesca had mentioned. She opened the door. "You are Eilish Fiorello?" The accent was Irish, with a trace, she thought, of Donegal, like a teacher she had had in school. Also, the way the man stood there as though waiting to be challenged reminded her of home. "I am," she said. "I've been looking for you." His tone was almost aggressive. She wondered if Tony's business could owe him money.
"So I hear."
"You are the wife of the plumber." Since the question sounded rude, she saw no reason to reply. "He is good at his job, your husband. I'd say he's in great demand." The man stopped for a second, looking behind him to check no one was listening. "He fixed everything in our house," he went on, pointing a finger at her. "He even did a bit more than was in the estimate. Indeed, he came back regularly when he knew that the woman of the house would be there and I would not. And his plumbing is so good that she is to have a baby in August." He stood back and smiled broadly at her expression of disbelief. "That's right. That's why I'm here. And I can tell you for a fact that I am not the father. It has nothing to do with me, but I am married to the woman who is having this baby, and if anyone thinks I'm keeping an Italian plumber's brat in my house and have my own children believe that it came into the world as decently as they did, they can have another think." He pointed a finger at her again. "So as soon as the little bastard is born, I'm transporting him here, and if you are not at home, then I will hand it to that other woman. And if there's no one at all in any of the houses you people own, I'll leave it right here on your doorstep." He walked towards her and lowered his voice. "And you can tell your husband from me that if I ever see his face anywhere near me, I'll come after him with an iron bar that I keep handy. Now have I made myself clear?" Eilish wanted to ask him what part of Ireland he was from, as a way of ignoring what he had said, but he had already turned away. She tried to think of something else to say that might engage him. "Have I made myself clear?" he asked again, as he reached his car. When she did not reply, he made as though to approach the house once more. "I'll be seeing you in August, or it could be late July, and that's the last time I'll see Eilish." "How do you know my name?" she asked. "That husband of yours is a great talker. That's how I know your name. He told my wife all about you." If he had been Italian or plain American, she would not have been sure how to judge whether he was making a threat he had no intention of carrying out. He was, she thought, a man who liked the sound of his own voice. But she recognized something in him, a stubbornness, perhaps even a sort of sincerity. She had known men like this in Ireland. Should one of them discover that their wife had been unfaithful and was pregnant as a result, they would not have the baby in the house. At home, however, no man would be able to take a newborn baby and deliver it to another household. He would be seen by someone. A priest or a doctor or a guard would make him take the baby back. But here, in this quiet cul-de-sac, the man could leave a baby on her doorstep without anyone noticing him. He really could do that. And the way he spoke, the set of his jaw, the determination in his gaze, convinced her that he meant what he was saying. Once he had driven away, she went back into the living room and sat down.
She closed her eyes. Somewhere, not far away, there was a woman pregnant with Tony's child. Eilish did not know why she presumed that the woman was Irish, too. Perhaps her visitor would be more likely to order an Irish woman around. Anyone else might stand up to him or leave him. Suddenly, the image of this woman alone with a baby coming to look for support from Tony frightened her even more than the image of a baby being left on her doorstep. But then that second image, too, when she let herself picture it in cold detail, made her feel sick. What if the baby was crying? Would she pick it up? If she did, what would she do then? As she stood up and moved to another chair, the man so recently in front of her, real and vivid and imposing, seemed like someone she had read about or seen on television. It simply wasn't possible that the house could be perfectly quiet one moment and then have this visitor arriving in the next. If she told someone about it, then she might know how to feel, what she should do. In one flash, an image of her elder sister Rose, dead now more than 20 years, came into her mind. All through her childhood, in even the smallest crisis, she could appeal to Rose, who would take control. She had never confided in her mother, who was, in any case, in Ireland with no telephone in her house. Her two sisters-in-law, Lena and Clara, were both from Italian families and close to each other, but not to Eilish. In the hallway, she looked at the telephone on its stand. If there was not one number she could call, one friend to whom she could recount the scene that had just been enacted at her front door, it wasn't that the man, whatever his name was, would become more real if she described him to someone. She had no doubt that he was real. What she wanted was someone to offer an interpretation of what had happened that would give her some consolation. At the moment, she herself could see none. The book that this excerpt is from is Long Island by Colm Tóibín, and it's $25 at Amazon and $26 at Bookshop. We're over in the word of the week, executive dysfunction. Yet another way our brains are constantly getting in our way. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. A brain that's running smoothly should feel like a video without lags or a record without scratches. In some cases, though, our minds might hit a snag. Instead of regularly flowing thoughts, it's like a big buffering cymbal or a song that keeps skipping on the same part. That's what executive dysfunction is, a disruption to certain brain processes that help us remember what we're doing in the moment and control our thoughts, emotions, and behavior. These executive functions, things like learning to focus on one task or remembering where you stashed something important, are typically developed throughout childhood. It's still being studied, but researchers know that executive dysfunction comes courtesy of various mental and physical health conditions and manifests differently depending on the condition. For example, people with ADHD may get easily distracted, while people with addictions might struggle with inhibition control. But dysfunction can also accompany anxiety and depression because your brain is focusing on immediate needs rather than higher level resources. It also goes hand in hand with diseases like Alzheimer's. A lapse can happen to anyone from time to time. If you've ever struggled to make a decision when hungry or reread the same paragraph when tired or stressed, you've experienced a disruption in your executive function, explains Rebecca Jackson, cognitive specialist and author of Back of Track. But occasional disruptions like these don't mean you have executive dysfunction. We all experience fluctuations, Jackson says. Individuals with executive function face these challenges daily. We're over in wellness with five things you can do now to prevent dementia. Crosswords and sardines are great, but there are other ways to stay sharp into old age, and it's never too early to start. This article is by Haley Levine. Sure, you know that learning a new language or doing daily crossword puzzles can help stave off cognitive decline. But let's face it, who has time? The good news is that there's a lot you can do to control the speed and rate of memory decline without ever having to play Wordle. In fact, a 2020 report in the medical journal The Lancet found that 12 controllable risk factors, including lack of exercise, smoking, and underlying conditions like high blood pressure or diabetes, are the cause of up to 40% of all dementia cases. There's a lot within your control that's easy to do, stresses Gary Small, MD, the chair of psychiatry at Hackensack University Medical Center and author of The Memory Bible. Here are 6 healthy strategies to adopt now that will help reduce your risk of dementia later in life. Exercise to prevent brain shrinkage. The number one thing you can do to delay the onset of dementia is to get enough physical exercise, says Small. It gets your heart to pump oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells and provides brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which acts like fertilizer to your brain neurons. It's especially important once you hit your mid-30s and 40s, he adds, which is when your hippocampus, the memory center of your brain, begins to shrink. Research suggests that exercise sessions of 45 to 60 minutes most days of the week offer the biggest brain benefits. Include high-intensity resistance exercise a couple days a week, too. A study published in 2020 in the journal NeuroImage found that 6 months of high-intensity resistance training also helps to prevent shrinkage of the hippocampus. Short on time? Do an intense quick burst of exercise. A 2023 study published in the Journal of Physiology found that 6 minutes of high-intensity exercise, like a bout of cycling, increases production of a specialized protein that boosts learning and memory and could protect your brain from age-related cognitive decline. It's also important to move around often, advises Small. Adults between ages 45 and 75 who sat at least 3 hours a day had substantial thinning of their medial temporal lobe, a part of the brain responsible for the formation of new memories, compared to those who sat less often. In a study published in the journal PLOS-1 in 2018, this thinning is usually a precursor to dementia, he notes. Eat more mindfully. A study published this past February in the journal Annals of Neurology found that a healthy diet slows the onset of dementia by slowing down your body's pace of biological aging. People who most closely follow the MIND diet, a plant-heavy eating pattern, had a reduced risk of dementia. The MIND diet includes at least 2 daily servings of veggies, including one that's leafy greens, 2 to 5 servings per week of berries, at least 3 daily servings of whole grains, at least 5 weekly servings of nuts and seeds, 3 to 4 servings per week of beans, at least 1 serving a week of fatty fish like salmon, mackerel, or sardines, at least 2 weekly servings of poultry, 2 tablespoons per day of extra virgin olive oil. Put more simply, focus on a plant-based diet that minimizes red meat, whole fatty dairy, processed foods, and refined sugars, all of which raise cholesterol and increase risk for type 2 diabetes, both of which increase your risk of dementia, says Small. Be fastidious about getting vaccines. It won't just lessen the likelihood of your getting sick or minimize the symptoms if you do. it appears to reduce the risk of your developing dementia. Getting vaccinated against diseases such as tetanitis, diphtheria, shingles, and pneumococcus is associated with a reduced risk to develop Alzheimer's disease, according to a 2023 study published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Another early study found that people who got at least one flu vaccine were 40% less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease compared to those who were unvaccinated. While it's unclear exactly why, one theory is that many vaccines have an anti-inflammatory effect, which helps protect the brain, says Small. Check your hearing and your teeth. Put these two items on your to-do list. Get your hearing checked and see your dentist regularly. Even very minor hearing losses can contribute to cognitive decline, according to a 2019 study published in JAMA. Otolaryngology head and neck surgery. Additionally, the bacteria that causes gum disease has been linked to dementia, so keep up with dental appointments and floss daily. While you're at it, if your doctor flags your blood pressure, cholesterol, or blood sugar levels during your annual checkup, take it seriously. These sorts of diseases damage the small blood vessels in the brain, which can contribute to dementia, stresses Caroline Fredericks, MD, a neurologist at Yale School of Medicine and Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut. That's why you want to get them under control as soon as possible. A 2022 study published in JAMA Network Open found that having higher blood pressure can even in young adulthood was linked to poorer brain health in middle age. Ask about hormone replacement therapy. If you've started to experience menopause symptoms such as hot flashes and night sweats, talk to your doctor about whether hormone replacement therapy, HRT, is right for you. It may be protective against dementia if it's taken in perimenopause or early postmenopause, per a 2023 meta-analysis of over 50 studies published in the journal Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience. There might be a window of opportunity for the effectiveness of HRT in terms of dementia risk reduction if it started 10 years before the start of menopause, or perhaps even before the final menstrual period during perimenopause, explains review author Lisa Mosconi, MD, director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program and Women's Brain Initiative at WEILL, that's W-E-I-L-L, Cornell Medicine in New York City. The theory is that during this time, your brain is more receptive to the positive effects of estrogen, which slows down cognitive decline. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Still in wellness, we have Women Who Start Things, Dr. Shefali Tazabiri. In her six groundbreaking books, psychologist Dr. Shefali has revolutionized the way we think about parenting. Now she's sharing her wisdom in a new podcast. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. Dr. Shefali Tazabiri is a clinical psychologist and international speaker and a three-time New York Times best-selling author. Her agenda-setting landmark books, The Conscious Parent and The Awakened Family, has transformed attitudes about modern parenting on a global scale. She's appeared on Super Soul Sunday three times, and Oprah is such a fan that she has a whole shelf in her house dedicated to copies of The Conscious Parent. Anytime anybody anywhere is having a baby or they tell me they're having problems with their kids, I send them the book, she says. Now everyone can experience Dr. Shefali's magic. This week she is launching her long-awaited podcast, Parenting and You with Dr. Shefali. Unlike parenting podcasts that feature banter between experts, she'll talk to a different family every week as they tackle dilemmas ranging from toddler troubles to grown children seeking to heal painful rifts. I want it to be practical and compassionate, she says. Here she tells us about the idea, how the idea came about, and her journey to creating this engrossing series. Where the idea came from. I wanted to make a podcast to help heal and transform parents. I thought, why are other parenting podcasts not answering the desperate call for help in real time? I do this in my daily life every single day. So I said, why not make it accessible to the hungry people out there that so need this? I really wanted to stay away from an intellectual podcast that just dabbles on surface topics, but instead make it about deep transformation so that the listener feels like they too are on a journey of healing. In order to achieve that, I had to do it in a different way. In typical parenting podcasts, there is one expert talking on one topic each week. But this one will feature real parents with real struggles being helped in real time. The goal. I wanted to help parents develop the tools and strategies to allow their children to become liberated, empowered, and whole. Every parent wants that, but very few have the skills and the strategies to do it. Not intentionally or out of laziness or lethargy, but because they themselves are so blocked from within. I help parents unlock their own inner blocks, because once you do, then the pathway to connect to your children becomes all the more illuminated. This is a podcast featuring universal teachings that will apply to any parent, no matter what issue they're going through. Parenting is such a lonely journey. You feel you're the only one going through the pain because you're embarrassed and ashamed to talk about your struggles. Parenting and You shows that everyone is going through it and brings up the universal element of our deep fear that we're not doing a good job. I hope this podcast will show that everyone is kind of losing their stuff, giving listeners that real camaraderie and universal commonality that is so healing. First steps. We put out a notice in parent communities for anyone looking for help with a problem. We got thousands of responses from people needing the help. We were so grateful because they cannot afford a therapist in real life. Hardest moment. Like any creative journey, the hardest part will always be working against your own barriers of unworthiness. So for me, personally, it was thoughts like, does anyone need one more podcast in the world? And that's why, in order to battle that critical voice within me, I made sure to create a unique podcast for people who want to grow and transform, heal their children, and heal their own childhood. I waited a long time to make it, until I saw a missing piece in the market and my chance to answer that missing piece. The moment you thought this just might work. Listening back to the episodes and hearing the epiphanies, a lot of crying, a lot of, oh my goodness, that hurts, but I see the truth of it. And thank you for showing me something I totally didn't think of before. I'm helping heal the parents. I give them a gift of their own healing, and that's why my work has been so transformative. The results. It's been such a joy. I recorded half the season already. It was so delicious to help people and so invigorating for me. I really relate to every listener so that they feel like I'm speaking to them directly, and they get a little bit of Dr. Shefali wisdom and compassion and some transformational tools every week. We're going to do follow-ups with parents, but already the parents who've been on the podcast have written to me saying that they are a changed parent and they got something from that podcast that no one had shown them before. I'm already getting such positive feedback. And really, my greatest desire for this podcast is that it makes some informational wisdom accessible. It makes my work more accessible to everyone around the globe. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Over in culture and news, Valerie Bertinelli posts raw Instagram video about motherhood and fans send their support. Watching her son Wolfgang Van Halen's Behind the Music episode prompted the actress to get personal about raising him. And this article is by Adriana Friedman. Valerie Bertinelli isn't one to shy away from speaking her truth, and she recently got vulnerable talking about the one thing that matters the most, her son, Wolfgang Wolfie Van Halen. On May 1st, Paramount Plus released an episode of MTV's Behind the Music, documenting Wolfie's life and his journey to becoming a musician, including his relationship with his father and Bertinelli's ex-husband, the late Eddie Van Halen. 2 days after the episode aired, fans saw Valerie upload an Instagram video expressing her raw feelings about watching her son's life be displayed for the world to see. As folks watched her process the hour-long episode, she vulnerably acknowledged that she felt like there were challenges in raising Wolfie in the public eye. "I was finally able to watch Wolfie's Behind the Music," she began the clip. "It was not easy. I had stopped it many times because it was just too brutal to watch for many reasons. One, seeing Wolfie's pain. Two, seeing what a better job I could have done as a parent, even though he turned out magnificently. I made a lot of mistakes." As Bertinelli gave minimal details about how the rise and fall of her relationship with Eddie affected Wolfie's upbringing, she also used the moment to note one important thing in her life. While she admitted she felt her love story with Eddie affected her more than she hoped, she emphasized Wolfie was the best part of her marriage to the Van Halen rocker. "After Ed died in 2020, I was more than willing to put myself in the grieving widow category for a man that I hadn't lived with for 20 years, she added. "What we had together was this beautiful son that we both unconditionally loved. That's what I got out of that marriage, is Wolfie, the best thing that ever happened to me." As Bertinelli's followers saw her get emotional about raising Wolfie, many related to her comments about motherhood. As a result, they rushed to her side to show their support. "You were a wonderful mom, and Ed was a great dad. Wolf loved you both. He always will," one person wrote in the comments. "Our love for our children is why we are all here. You are amazing, and you are also an amazing mom," another agreed. "Thank you for your courage and honesty. You're an example to so many. Be good to yourself, Valerie. You deserve it," a different follower added. Despite Bertinelli getting candid about the hardships of motherhood, no one can deny how proud she is of Wolfie. She stood alongside him and his wife, Andrea Alsop, as he was part of the team nominated for Best Original Song at the 2024 Oscars. And when she appeared on Good Morning America in early April, she shared Eddie would have been so proud of everything their son has accomplished. Again in culture and news, Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck dispel divorce rumors in a family outing with Jennifer Garner. Ben even subtly revealed the sweet name he saved Jennifer's number under in his phone. This is by Chelsea Sanchez. Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck have embarked on another blended family outing amid rumors that the two are separated. On May 19, the actors arrived together at a Los Angeles movie theater where they attended a film event alongside Affleck's ex-wife Jennifer Garner and her and Affleck's kids, Violet, 18, Finn, 15, and Samuel, 12, according to the Daily Mail. Lopez's 16-year-old Emmy, whom she shares with ex-husband Mark Anthony, was also in attendance. Lopez looks sophisticated in a khaki green ensemble composed of an illustrated Dior trench coat and matching pleated wide leg trousers. She finished off the look by tucking in a cream ribbed knit top and adding olive green Christian Louboutin lace up stiletto boots, a shiny emerald green Lady Dior bag, and her go-to pair of octagonal Chloe sunglasses. Affleck looked casual in gray Red Sox t-shirt that says "Full Throttle Believe in Boston," plus jeans and white sneakers. The two were later seen driving in a car together, where Affleck appeared to be receiving a call from Lopez on his phone. In photos captured by his paparazzi, His screen showed her appearing as Jennifer Affleck on his phone with a casual glam headshot. The low-key appearance comes and widespread speculation about the couple's marriage ending. Rumors Lopez and Affleck were divorcing first emerged after news outlets noted they hadn't been photographed together in 47 days, and talked to sources who said the two stars were experiencing marital issues. Last week, multiple sources told People the husband and wife are living under separate roofs, with Affleck staying at one of their other properties as he films The Accountant 2. Rumors of a split were exacerbated when Affleck was spotted on various outings over the weekend without his wedding ring. Lopez and Affleck married in the summer of 2022 in a secret Las Vegas chapel ceremony, followed by a lavish Georgia bash. Their nuptials came nearly two decades after the stars were initially set to wed in 2004, before they called off their highly publicized engagement. Still in culture and news, Katie Holmes and daughter Suri Cruz coordinate in baggy denim for a rainy day in NYC. The teen rounded out her fit with her favorite workwear-inspired jacket. This article is by Rosa Sanchez. Suri Cruz is taking style cues from her stylish mother, Katie Holmes. The duo coordinated in baggy denim looks for a rainy day in the New York City on May 16th. The Dawson's Creek alum's choice of denim was a pair of blue high-waisted bell-bottom jeans. She wore them with a cozy tan sweater with a bulky ribbed turtleneck, and over it, she layered on a breezy beige trench coat. The lightweight outerwear also matched the tone of Holmes's leather shoulder bag. The actor and director finished her casually sophisticated fit with black Adidas Sambas, a black belt, and oval tortoiseshell sunglasses, as well as her favorite tiny gold earrings and nose hoop. Holmes's 18-year-old daughter took a more street-style approach to her ensemble. Wearing her baggy blue jeans with a workwear-inspired denim jacket featuring big pockets and a tan suede collar. Underneath, she wore a white graphic crop tee. For footwear, Cruz kept it practical with a pair of tan suede Birkenstock clogs, and like her mom, accessorized with some simple gold jewelry. The mother and daughter are often seen out together in the city. Last month, they were photographed wearing totally different looks while on a coffee run. Then, Holmes opted for a preppy fit composed of a sweater layered over a button-up and paired with wide-leg jeans and Adidas Sambas, and Cruz went full boho in a patterned maxi dress, brown boots, and the same denim jacket. In culture and news, Hunter McGrady on the power of her Sports Illustrated swimsuit cover by Casey Hurwitz. By now, you've probably seen the stunning Sports Illustrated swimsuit cover featuring our very own Gayle King. Missed it? Check it out here. But in true Sports Illustration fashion, there are three other dazzling cover stars who deserve appreciation, too. Hunter McGrady, Chrissy Teigen, and Kate Upton. In celebration of McGrady's jaw-dropping photo shoot, see her cover below, we caught up with the model, podcast host, and mom of two to learn what the moment means to her. Watch her speak above or read on for a few of her takeaways. It's all about empowerment. The main thing I hope that women feel when they look at this cover, I hope that they feel empowered. I hope that they see themselves in me. Beauty is not a number. Beauty is not a size. It's not an age. It's not a gender. It's not an ethnicity. It's all of us. And I hope that when you look at these covers and when you look inside the magazine, that transcends. Every body is a swimsuit body. The biggest piece of advice that I would give a woman out there who might feel self-conscious at the beach or is refusing to wear or even put on a swimsuit is just try. Just go for it. Dare yourself to do it. Do it fearlessly. Do it bravely. And I promise you, it will come through. Changing the narrative. I made a vow to myself, I will never tear down my body and I will never say anything negative about my body in front of my children, because anything that we hear from home becomes a part of the fabric of our being. It starts with us. I think that there's a real big opportunity here to change the narrative, and the world's watching. This is so much bigger than just a beautiful photo. It's the story behind who each woman is, her accomplishments, her value, and what she brings to the world. That is where the impact lies. And the fact that I can do it on a stage as big and vast as Sports Illustrated Swimsuit is such a huge accomplishment. Next up in culture and news, Sofia Vergara, 51, opens up about aging and potentially having all white hair. The actress is taking the process into her own hands, by Kayla Blanton. We've heard from plenty of celebrities about aging and going gray. Some choose to embrace the change as early as possible, opting for the transitional salt and pepper look, and some swear they'll dye their locks until death. At 51, Sofia Vergara is leaning more toward the latter. For People's 2024 Beautiful issue, she shared that she's all about getting older. She just doesn't know that she could ever go for all white hair. Introducing the topic, the magazine asked the Hot Pursuit star how she viewed people her age when she was younger. I have to be honest with you. I thought it was old. Like, that's it, Vergara admitted. And now I feel great. I know I don't look the same, but I don't think I'm going to ever be the woman that has the courage to be, like, all white hair. White hair or not, she can't wait for her 32-year-old son, Manolo, to promote her to Abuela, she says. I think I'll be a fun grandmother. Vergara blames her hesitancy about going gray on her Colombian roots. I think because I'm Latin, we always grow up thinking about looking good, doing your hair, your makeup. It's something that makes you feel good, she said. I love beauty products. I love makeup. I love clothes. And I think now that I'm older, it's great because you know exactly what you like, what looks good on you, and what doesn't look good on you. I don't do what is in fashion. I just do what feels good, makes me feel confident and beautiful. Even if she does get the wild urge to try something new, more times than not, it doesn't happen. I'm always scared. I always say, oh, I'm going to cut my hair. But then I end up not cutting it, she explained. In Latin America, I mean, they used to tell you that once you hit 40, you're not supposed to have this crazy long hair. So I'm always thinking, like, is it time? Is it time to cut it? I don't know. I don't want to feel like old-fashioned with short hair. She may not be one to reach for the scissors, but in her 5 decades, Vergara's tried just about every beauty hack there is, she admitted. That's where she's not afraid. I've done it all. I mean, you tell me to put cement under your eye, you're going to look younger? I'll do it immediately, she said. It's like I put coconut oil on my head. I put it on my feet. I've wrapped myself in plastic with Aquaphor up to the neck. I'll do it. I don't care. It's not stupid. Even so, Vergara said she is learning to appreciate all aspects of aging. When asked what she liked most about getting older, she replied, "It's all the knowledge. That's all. I've never really cared that much about what people think. But now I really care less." Also, this stage of life has shifted her priorities a bit as she enters menopause, she explained. I take sleeping seriously now. Before, I could survive on 6 hours. Now I know that I don't look good if I don't sleep more, she said. If I have a photo shoot, I try to wake up a little bit earlier because you're puffier. You need some more time. Our job as actors, it's not like put your glasses on and go pick up your kid at school or go and sit in a desk. You have to be camera ready and do your job, but it takes longer now that I'm older. Vergara is taking her own approach to aging, and that on its own is empowering. Over in books, what loving feels like to a man. In his new book, Another Word for Love, Carvel Wallace shares how he recognized love and joy during what should have been just a simple chore, making salad, by Carvel Wallace. The three of us had been snacking for the better part of the early afternoon, filling a table with everything we could carry. Crackers, both fancy and goldfish, multiple cheeses, winter mandarins, two kinds of smoked salmon, smoked cod, chocolate, three kinds of chips, and an exceedingly mediocre store-bought hummus that we tried and failed to spruce up with lemon, smoked paprika, garlic, and salt. One of us mentioned offhandedly that she always keeps dill and parsley in her fridge, and that she makes a thing with it that she described as having only a few ingredients and being able to go on anything. Maybe I'll make it, she said, getting up from the table and heading into the kitchen. It was my first time meeting her. She was a friend of a friend, but I knew her a little from online. She used to run an inspirational food nonprofit that I saw stories about in local news. It shuttered during the pandemic. She was now working as a costume designer on a TV show shooting locally. She located a salad spinner, it was not her kitchen, and took out an unusually large and verdant bunch of Italian flat leaf parsley. I watched as she separated each strand of parsley, briefly inspecting it and setting aside the less than acceptable ones while she told us the story of her trip to her mother's homeland. She described rocky, failing roads, bumpy pickup trucks, small villages where the women looked so much like her mother that it brought her to tears. A village elder who spoke no English and lived in a tiny shelter that he shared with his livestock, into which he invited her to drink and laugh at the bare table. She was the guest of honor. I watched as she worked over the herbs. After she had reduced the pile by only 5% by taking out the slightly wilted ones, she began to take the leaves from the stalk, individually. There was no hurry to the way she worked, nor was there speed. She peeled each leaf as if we had all day to peel leaves. We did not. But it was then that I realized that we did. I found myself mesmerized with the slowness. If I am ever tasked with making something out of herbs, my method is to rinse them, chop them, throw them into the dish, and then move on to the next thing. My mind kept stuttering over the fact that she was taking so long, almost as if there was something wrong with how long she was taking, though I could not name what it was. Her story had become funny, something about finding a poster of a shirtless Kanye wearing a gold cross in a remote and unlikely place in her family's village. We were laughing. She had done such a good job of painting the characters in the story that when I think back on that moment, it seems odd that there were only three of us in the room. I seem to remember there being dozens of us, a whole dinner party, in fact. She moved on to the dill, repeating the same process, rinsing, drying, picking over, peeling each leaf with painstaking attention. Now she was describing a feast that was made for her. Her visit had coincided with the celebration of a local baby. Where her people are from, she explained, it is forbidden to see the baby before it has survived for 90 days. She happened to arrive to the village on the baby's 90th day, and relatives from near and far had come to celebrate these twin blessings. The alcohol was flowing. There was laughter and music. She thought the food would be presented in some formal way at some point, but she soon learned that the food just kept coming. Dish after dish after dish after dish. Everything was delicious. The thing is, she explained, fiddling with and then fixing the salad spinner, which had gone off the track, it's considered rude to have any part of the table that doesn't have food on it. So, like, if there's, like, even a space this big, and here she took her hands from the fresh, wet dill and demonstrated a shape roughly the size of a small paperback book. Someone will, like, put a lemon wedge or some leaves on a dish just to fill up that space. It was here that I noticed how the fuchsia of her nails made gorgeous symmetry with the green of the dill. Soon she was mixing the herbs in a small bowl with salt and olive oil and red pepper flakes. Considering the labor that had gone into it, the final product struck me as a remarkably small amount of food. I found myself once again trying to understand where this constant measure of efficiency and output was coming from. It was a Saturday. We were ostensibly on a mini vacation. I did not have a place to be, nor a time to be there. I tried to imagine working this slowly in my home kitchen, and I could not. I love cooking. I seem to be good at cooking. But lately, cooking has become a means to an end, a short work break that also makes it possible for me to eat, a thing that makes a mess and takes up time, a thing that I'd have to wrap up quickly so I could get back to work. It occurred to me that this person was treating the preparing of food as the meal in and of itself. "I just like it," she explained, as if reading my thoughts, "because when I was little, this is all my mother and aunts would let me do. Take the leaves off the herbs," they would say. "Take the leaves off the herbs." So when I smell these herbs, it reminds me of them. She took a few more tastes, made a few more adjustments. When she was done, we each scooped a little spoonful of the stuff onto toasted rye bread with smoked fish on it. It was good. Not mind-blowing, just good. Very good. Good enough that I thought about it that night when I went to bed, and in the morning when I woke up, good enough that I wrote about it. Good enough that I decided to remember that it happened. It is nearly Lunar New Year, when the night sky is unlit by the moon, the one period of time in which you can rest from your work in the fields. So you use it to join with the people you love. You come to them, and they to you with gifts. You bring joy to them. You hope for good blessings. My good blessing this new year has been a story and a pair of hands that touched each leaf as if each leaf were a loving, living thing, as if I deserved to eat things that had been loved in this way. In the quiet of the new moons, in the cold of the nights, wherever you are, I hope you know that you, too, deserve to eat things that have been loved in this way, to hear stories in which each word, each sentence has been caressed in the luminescent glow of afternoon sunlight, trimmed and lacquered in a sparkling fuchsia. I hope you know that you deserve that, and that each of us, from times before we were even born, always has. This comes from the book that accompanies this article, Another Word for Love by Carvel Wallace. You can find it for $25 at Amazon or $26 at Bookshop. This is also in books, Why Every Kid Needs a Kooky Grandma. The novelist and author of new picture book Gaga Mistake Day, which she co-wrote with her mom, shares the joys of sharing her outgoing, quirky mother with her kids, by Emma Straub. We arrived at the airport during the eclipse. I'd been too harried to prepare and figured I'd catch the next one, only a mere 40 years away. When my mother and I got out of our taxi, though, a handful of airport workers were standing just outside the terminal's automatic sliding doors, staring up at the sun, both hands holding their special glasses firmly in place. "Want to look?" one of them asked. We said yes, and there it was, in a sea of black, a small crescent visible as the sun hid behind the moon. Inside the airport, everyone we spoke to was curious about what was going on outside. My mother talked to the man at security. She talked to the man running the X-ray machine. She talked to the person at the Shake Shack. Even without the help of a rare celestial event, my mother makes friends wherever she goes. Thinking about it now, I should have known we wouldn't miss it because I was traveling with my mother. We were setting out on a week-long book tour in support of our new picture book. The book is about a kooky grandmother who is very much like my mother. Luckily, when you write a picture book, the questions you field from the audience tend to be more about what your cat's names are, rather than where the line is between fiction and nonfiction. When I describe my mother to people who haven't met her, I usually say that she looks just like me, only little. Despite my being 6 inches taller, probably 60 or 70 pounds heavier, and 35 years younger, my iPhoto cannot distinguish between our faces. If you hear the words book tour, you might imagine dimly lit bookstores and bookish people sitting in folding chairs. For picture book authors, the scene is more like this. Sneakers squeaking on gymnasium floors, a sea of upturned faces, loud laughter, and excess of boisterous, spirited audience participation. We made a slideshow that had pictures of my cats and of us doing various things that the characters do in the book. baking cakes, playing dress-up, reading books. In between these events, there are taxis or airplanes or trains or the back seats of kind women's minivans, sometimes all of the above. We were both listening to Barbra Streisand's audiobook, and so sometimes in the back seat we'd both be with Barbara and then would compare notes on her love affairs. Over the next week, we went to 8 schools and half a dozen bookstores. She wore a green outfit. I wore the exact same outfit in pink, both of us with our names embroidered over the breast pocket. At one of the first school visits, when the slide of our own maternal grandmother was up on the screen, my mother said something like, "My grandmother was sick a lot." The children, of course, asked questions about this, and it occurred to me that I didn't know the answer. When Mom and I were writing the book, we talked about her role as a grandmother to my children, her inventiveness, her silliness, her wacky meals, her willingness to cuddle the kids who are now as big as she is. But I don't think she's ever said anything to me about her grandparents, and I'd realized I'd never asked. My mother's parents were old for the time, her mother in her 30s and her father almost 40 when she was born in 1944. Her maternal grandmother died when her own mother was a teenager, her paternal grandmother elderly and unwell. And so, my mother grew up without grandmothers, and certainly without grandmothers who would get on the floor with her, who would walk backward to the park, or who would bake cakes for her stuffed animals. I, too, grew up largely without grandmothers. My father's mother had Alzheimer's disease and existed to me only as a body without a memory. We visited her in nursing homes full of people that frightened me, and it made my father so sad that we didn't visit very often. For most of my life, my maternal grandparents lived across the country, though for a few years before my grandmother died, they lived nearby. We both loved horses and fashion. She always had her hair done, wore Ferragamo heels, and perfectly put together outfits. I don't know that she ever sat on the floor. She and I got our ears pierced together, which was certainly participatory for a woman who wore clip-ons for the first 7 decades of her life. She died when I was 8, the age my younger son is now. I like to think that if she had lived longer, we would have been able to enjoy each other even more. She hadn't loved having small children. Not everyone does. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.